This podcast is brought to you by the Dutch media platform Triathlon Inside. One, two, three, four. What is up, guys, and welcome back to Grit Grind Girona. Today, it's the second Australian in a row in our podcast. Our guest of today, he's master of both endurance and storytelling, I think. Because, yeah, some people tell stories with words and others with paddles and pain. But as I said, today's guest does both. With a camera slung over his shoulder and a bike, either a gravel road or now even a triathlon bike, aimed at adventure, challenge, and the stories that unfold when comfort is left behind. Meet Tristan Cardew, filmmaker, photographer, and ultra-endurance cyclist. From the dusty trails of the Atlas Mountains to the vibrant streets of Girona, Tristan has built a reputation for capturing the raw, honest beauty of life on two wheels. His YouTube channel is packed with immersive storytelling, and his own adventure stretches across some of the world's most unforgiving landscapes. But even for someone who's conquered deserts and distance, last week brought a first, his debut triathlon. It wasn't just a race, it was an experience on its own. Tristan claimed a slot for the 70.3 Ironman World Championships in Marbella later this year, but also walked away with a fractured elbow after a crash in the middle of the race. Pain, progress, and perspective. It looks like just another chapter in Tristan's story. In this episode, we talk about risk, resilience, and the ever-evolving relationship between body, bike, and camera. This is Grit Grind Girona, and yeah, you're about to hear why Tristan doesn't just chase the shot, but I think he lives it as well. Tristan, welcome on the show.
Thank you so much. What an intro.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
How are you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm good. I've had an interesting sort of week of downtime after fracturing my elbow. But I feel pretty good. I find it interesting when you have an injury to go through like what you almost call the stages of grief, where like there's a sort of the initial few stages of like you don't want to accept it, and then eventually you do accept it, and then eventually you kind of come to grips with it. And it's actually been nice to go, okay, I did my race, I got what I wanted out of the race, mm-hmm. other than the fractured elbow and the hospital bill. but then to be like, okay, now is actually the perfect time to have some downtime, because, you know, I'll hit another couple of races in the next few months once I'm healed, and then Worlds. But if I'm going to have downtime, it's like the perfect time right after
to do
a
it
race.
Now, yeah. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So. All right, Manuel, for sure we're going to be talking about this, what was happening last week, later on in the show. Just like every podcast, I will explain right now what we're going to be doing in the next, hopefully something like an hour or so. First of all, I'd like to get to know you a little bit better, see how you started out with sports, how do you are in Girona, these kind of things, you know, what have you been up to so far in life? So that we're going to be starting off with like a first round of quick fire questions.
Okay.
After that, we're going to talk a little bit about it, you know, to dive a little bit deeper into your story. And eventually we'll come to the point where we're probably going to be talking a little bit more about Girona as well. And again, we do another round of quick fire questions about Girona specifically.
Okay.
And after that, we're getting towards the end of the podcast, and I think it's cool to be looking a little bit ahead to the future, what's coming up in the next year or this year. Well, already 70.3 Worlds Pro, for example, but do you have big plans for the future and these kind of things? And we finish it off with like a couple of follower questions from Instagram. So that's basically what we're going to be doing. And are you ready for a first round of quick fire questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. What is your proudest achievement in sports?
You touched on it briefly in the intro. For me, it was probably finishing the Atlas Mountain Race. Atlas Mountain Race was 5 days across the Moroccan desert, yeah. Nonstop. I think in 5 days I slept 10 hours or so, or maybe less. And I had like a wrist issue during it. And so to finish 5 days of riding nonstop, fully self-supported, didn't know what I was getting myself into. And then to finish that felt like, even though I wasn't even in the top 10 or anything, it wasn't a podium. It was one of the things that I think I'm most proud of. And I filmed a video the entire way and then made a video out of it so people can see that and sort of see what I went through. So yeah, I think that's my proudest sporting achievement.
Nice. What has been, maybe it is Atlas Mountains, but what has been your hardest event so far? Toughest, hardest event?
Atlas was definitely tough, mm-hmm. both physically and mentally. More mentally, because when I stepped into the Atlas Mountain race, I was really excited. And because it was my first ultra, I like was really excited for all the adventures I was going to have, because people talk about the adventure. What I wasn't expecting was how tough it would be mentally to mm-hmm. be out there by myself, kind of riding injured through the desert and with a lot of uncertainty around it. And that sort of uncertainty created a lot of mental challenges for me. And then, to get to the end. So yeah, that was definitely, I think, the toughest, even though physically the riding was not the craziest thing ever. It was just long distance, but mm-hmm. yeah, it was tough all around.
What languages do you speak?
Oh man, that's an embarrassing one. I speak English and I speak a bit of Spanish. I understand bits of Catalan as well.
Okay.
And as a result, I understand like little bits of French and Italian, but languages are not my forte. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Maybe besides Atlas Mountains, because maybe this is your first answer, what is your most memorable finish line moment?
I think I did a road race a couple of years ago, 2023, here in Catalonia. It was called the Gran Premi de Odena, and it's a road race that I did. I've done it like 5 times, and it was always the toughest race for me on the calendar out of the Catalan circuit and all of the races I'd done. Like not only the course, but the people that show up, and just the way to get a win there is quite difficult. And yeah, on my 5th attempt, I finally won. Like I rode away solo with like 15Ks to go and got over the last climb by myself and then just bombed it to the finish. And just the feeling of after 5 attempts at the same race to like then get the result, to get the win, that was something that like, it was totally different to Atlas Mountain race. It's a road race, you know, but I got to the end of that and I was like, that was a really big tick in the box for me. Like a race that is really, really tough, that I had tried at so many years and really wanted to do well at, to finally achieve that felt really, really good.
There's something probably I haven't done it before, but for ultra endurance events, something special about, you know, finishing it off. There's also really something special about winning something. Eh?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Totally. I mean, at the end of the day, like even though I speak about Atlas Mountain race, like at my core, I'm a bike racer, like a road racer. That's what I love. I love going fast. I love sort of the tactics in road racing. So to get a win on the road, it doesn't happen very often, you know, and so when you get one, it feels really, really good, especially in a race that to me was such a special race. It wasn't just a race I was showing up to just compete at. It was a race that I was like, I want that, you know.
So, nice.
Yeah.
Who is one person you look up to for inspiration?
Oh, that's a hard one. There's no one person. I really look to like lots and lots of different people for their different strengths. This is not a short, I'll make it short because of quick fire. But for me, I sort of believe that everyone has their strength. And so like I look to lots of different people for like their one strength. I know people who are like great bike racers, but they, you know, like other areas of their life, they need work. And for other people, they're not great athletes, but they're great humans. So I wouldn't name one person, but I love looking for that trait in each individual that provides some source of inspiration for me, and then trying to draw on their positive attributes and trying to apply that to my own life.
And cool answer, but is and like for more of your like social media or like YouTube or Instagram, is that some are there some people you are looking for to the inspiration as well, or
a few people? I really like people who create content that is obviously unique.
Yeah,
so there's an account on Instagram, it's one guy, his account is rmdub @rmdub. I can't even remember his name. I think it's Ryan.
All right.
And he rides around in like South America, Patagonia, like really interesting places, and takes beautiful photos. And he sends his photos to, it's just him bikepacking, and he camps, and then he sends his photos to like bikepacking.com on a regular basis. And they do like features of where he's been riding. And his content is so unique. He'll be in the middle of like the Atacama Desert or something like this, and he'll set up his tent and the mountains in the background will look incredible. He's a great photographer. He loves just riding his bike around, and the photos he produces to me are like really unique. Like when you scroll Instagram, every time I see his stuff, I stop on it.
It just pops up.
It pops out. Yeah. So from a photography standpoint, I think what he's doing is great. I really love Road Toads, who's a guy in the US. He just creates funny reels. He's worth checking out just from like a sort of a self-deprecating, like funny reels kind of guy. I mean, I've got a whole bunch of photography inspirations that are not within cycling.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's hard these days. Instagram is such a wash of, you know, so many content creators and so many people doing cool stuff. It's hard to kind of pick one and be like, ah, this guy, you know, or this guy. So,
yeah.
But cool. Yeah, I think RM Dub is like, he's great.
Nice. What is your dream event destination?
I was thinking about this when I heard you ask it to Taylor in the previous podcast. I was thinking, actually, you know what? Like, I just came back from Switzerland. Switzerland is so beautiful. It is genuinely a postcard everywhere you look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny to be like, oh, I just came back and I would go there again. But I would go there again in a heartbeat. It's so beautiful. The lakes are amazing.
Lakes are like even turquoise, right?
Yeah, turquoise lakes. There's lots of them. You know, you could hold, say we're talking triathlon, you could hold or a bike race, you could hold a triathlon in so many different areas where the lakes are because they're freshwater, they're beautiful. You know, and the roads are amazing, the views are amazing. I was blown away. And I've been to Switzerland a couple of times, but this trip, because I went with my girlfriend Natalie and we drove all the way through Switzerland. So we drove from Girona to the race in Rapperswil. So we drove all the way through Switzerland and it blew my mind driving rather than flying, how much you realize the entire country is beautiful. It's not like you fly and then, you know, you arrive in a place and you're like, this place is beautiful.
Yeah.
You see the entire way. The entire country is stunning.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Cool. What is your favorite movie?
Oh, I got a few. I really like, I was talking with Natalie about this actually 2 days ago. Shawshank Redemption is a classic one. Fight Club I really like David Fincher movies. Just I think the way he directs is really interesting. He's like creates a lot of tension, a lot of suspense. And again, it's quite unique, you know. Like there's certain movies where the storytelling is the main element. When you think about, say, Shawshank Redemption, it's a beautiful story or whatever. It's a bit of a classic movie to mention, but you know, that's a great story, but David Fincher's movies, you almost watch not for the storytelling, but more for the way it's shot
mm-hmm.
and the sort of tension that's created throughout. So yeah, like Fight Club and Seven and a bunch of different David Fincher movies are sort of up there.
Being a question in between, but being a videographer, photographer, maybe yes, maybe no, I have no idea, but that's why I ask. Do you look to movies or these kind of things different than, for example, a normal or not really known person about like videography? Do you look to it differently? Like how do they shoot this, or how have they been doing this? Do you think about it during movies or not really?
If the movie's well shot, I do. I can sit down and watch a movie and not apply a photographer lens to it. Sure. But if it's well shot, then it starts to be inspiring for me. So, you know, like you say, if you think about a Wes Anderson film, obviously everybody watches Wes Anderson mm-hmm. films and goes, oh, they look incredible because of his style and because of the meticulous nature of the way they shot it. And the way that Wes sort of directs it and everything and creates the videos or the shots. So yeah, if I start watching something that my brain picks up on as being like aesthetic, then I start really thinking about it. You know, then I start thinking, oh, could I use...
Exactly. Can I learn from this? Or could I use this in my way?
Yeah. Exactly. Could I integrate something? Yeah. You know, I really like, I had a big period with back in Australia as a wedding photographer, and I had a big period with where I was like, oh, I want to try and create Wes Anderson style images, really symmetrical, really clean, you know, very parallel with the background and all these sorts of things, because I guess I'd watched some Wes Anderson films and just taken a lot of inspiration from it. So yeah.
Is there still, you have done already a lot of like really cool events, but is there still an event you haven't done before you would really like to do?
Yeah, I have to say now I've been looking into triathlon, especially the last 12 months, but especially the last 6 months.
There suddenly is a whole new world of events.
There's a whole new world of events, and I'm actually really excited about it because, you know, having now done the road races, and that's something we could talk about in a while, but having done the road races I've done, I feel like I've done my road racing, and now it's like, okay, what can I look forward to? Because I can't obviously be like, oh, I'd like to do the Tour de France, because that's not going to happen, or any Grand Tours or even any professional races, but... What I can do is what I've discovered I really like about triathlon is I can go and do pro race, like, you know, races where there are professionals, compete on the same course, compare myself to the fastest guys. And there's so many events. Triathlon, it's incredible how many events there are. So, yeah, I couldn't name a specific one, maybe Challenger Roth at some point, you know, a full distance Ironman down the track. for sure, or, you know, or challenge.
I already answered one of my questions later on in the podcast.
I knew that one was going to come. But yeah, so no, just bigger distance events. Yeah,
I think it's, and I experienced it a little bit when I started out with gravel riding a little bit last year. And for sure, I only did Santa Val and Traca in Girona over here. But now for you as well, like going into a totally new sport you're not familiar with, is like suddenly a whole new world pops opens up, and you're again a beginner of something, right? That's pretty strange and cool, but also like some sort of like nervous feeling, kind of.
Yeah, I think there's something humbling about being a beginner. You know, there's something nice. There's something really positive about being a beginner, especially when you feel like, I feel within cycling, I've achieved what I want to achieve. I haven't achieved the greatest things in the world, but I've gotten to a level with cycling where I'm very happy. And I feel not only like I've ticked the box, not ticked the box and I closed the door, but more I've ticked the box and I'm content. And I like the idea of going back to being a beginner, because the learning curve is so steep. Mm-hmm. And that learning curve, when the learning curve is really steep, that's where the most enjoyment is, because you feel a constant sense of progress. You know, I'm still going to the pool and getting faster literally every time I swim now. And so that feels great. Whereas with the bike, I go out and it's like, okay, I hit the same numbers I've done for the last few years. I'm doing the same sort of thing. So being a beginner is awesome.
Nice. What is your favorite sport outside of cycling, running, and triathlon now?
Running and swimming are not even in my top like five.
Okay.
For me, surfing was always a big one. Surfing was the biggest one growing up.
Yeah.
Surfing, skateboarding. I was like the sort of, did more of the, what you would call like extreme sports, like, you know, surfing, skateboarding. Skiing is another big one. But yeah, surfing was the one that's kind of permeated my whole life, from like a love of, I love all the aspects of surfing. So like, you know, obviously being outdoors, but then, you know, being in nature, understanding nature, because you have to understand how waves are created and why work in the way they work.
The power, or how do you call it, from the water. It's insane, right?
It's incredible how powerful the ocean is. So yeah, surfing's been a really big one for me.
Nice.
So.
If you could train, and you have been training with a lot of like professional cyclists and really like some of the top level cyclists, but if you could train with any athlete in history, who would it be?
Oh, I wish I could run as fast as Kipchoge, you know, or run at the level, to the level that I could keep up with him and train with him. I think if I could speak, you know, if I could have a chat with him while we're running, you know, I think he's a really introspective and reflective person.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a classic one, you know, he's sort of the GOAT. So everyone's like, Kipchoge, you know, but I think more his personality. I find it interesting training with people, not strictly just for their physical ability, but also the way they
think about life, or
The way they look at life, the way they sort of, their training philosophy, or maybe not even related to sport, but more just their general outlook on life. Kelly Slater, professional surfer from like a pure physical raw ability. You know, he's 58 years old or whatever. I don't know, maybe he's not that old, but like, you know, he's older and he's still the GOAT. So yeah, he would be cool as well.
Nice. Who's the funniest sports person you know?
Oh, that's actually a hard one. Funniest. I don't think I could answer that. Funniest.
Who did you have the most laughs with?
Maybe I'm too serious, but I'm just thinking like, oh, I don't know. Like,
during your rides, always serious talk.
Yeah, I mean, it must be that thing where I'm too serious. So I don't you don't have a laugh with people. I don't know. I might have to say pass. Right. I'll think about that next time. Yeah.
Are you more of an early bird or night owl?
Definitely a night owl. Yeah, I'm not good at waking up early.
Maybe you already answered this answer already, but if you could visit any country tomorrow, where would you go?
I would go back to Japan.
Japan.
I spent 2 weeks in Japan last year, January, like over the New Year period between 2023 and 2024. Japan's an amazing country. So beautiful. The people are incredible. It's just so different culturally that it felt like a combination of adventure while having safety and security, while having like a totally new experience and being able to experience new things, but still within a certain level of comfort. You know, I'm even though I've done like the Atlas Mountain race and things like that, I'm not a person that loves to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I like a certain level of comfort. You know, some people are like, oh, I want to go to Tajikistan, or I want to go, well, Tajikistan's safe. I want to go, you know, somewhere in the Middle East or something like that. For me, I'm more like, you know what? I like being in like a comfortable but new environment.
Yeah.
So.
Did you went there like for holidays or like just enjoyment, or did you took your bike as well there?
I went skiing. I went for 2 weeks, cool. And so we did 5 days of skiing and then about 7 or 8 days of travel around.
Nice.
So yeah, no bike riding at that point.
Do you listen to any music or podcast during your riding training?
I don't generally. I actually, I only just started listening to podcasts very recently, occasionally, nice. More on gravel rides for the safety element. But yeah, I don't actually listen to that much. It sounds weird, but I quite like the sound of my own thoughts. You know, I like thinking. So yeah.
Nice. Do you prefer training with on your own or with other people?
I like training on my own. Yeah, for me, I don't know why. I couldn't really explain specifically other than the fact that I just like focusing on what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I find when I'm with other people, I'm more, I feel like I lean into what the other person wants a bit. And so I'm like kind of trying to people please a little bit, mm-hmm, which might mm-hmm, sound mm-hmm. weird, but yeah, like I guess
no,
I just...
No, for sure. I understand what you mean.
Yeah. I like being a bit selfish when I'm training.
Yeah.
And that's like going and doing my own thing. Or if I'm training with someone else, it's like one person and we have a specific goal in mind. Yeah. Like we're either going for a social ride or we're either doing intervals or we're, you know, we've got some mutual agreement.
Nice.
So, yeah.
What's one thing still on your bucket list?
Oh man, there's actually heaps of things on my bucket list.
Then what are one more things on your bucket list?
Okay, so here's one that I had since I was like young, 13 or 14. There's in the Amazon, there's a river and there's a tidal wave that is created within the river called the Pororoca. It's like a wave that comes, the river's usually flat and then this sort of tidal bore comes through the river and it creates these like perfect, beautiful waves. And I always had on my bucket list, I'd love to go, I believe it's the Amazon, and go and surf the Pororoca. That's something that like, I don't know if it'll ever happen. There are some videos on Instagram now of people surfing it. I watched a video literally 20 years ago and I was like, I want to do that. And I haven't kind of, it's always been in the back of my mind. I haven't gone and done it. And then Instagram videos have showed up recently of people surfing this wave. And I've just been like, oh, that's still on the bucket list. So
cool.
Yeah, maybe when I retire from like endurance, but I'll get back in surfing. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, there's not much surfing going on over here in Girona, close by to Girona.
No.
That's one cool thing. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Nice. That's, that we're like, well, quick fire. Maybe should start to like, because it always ends up like really nice and cool stories. I should have changed up the words about quick fire questions, but yeah, some cool answers over there. Thanks for that. And I think it's, moving on to a little bit more understanding like where you come from. For sure, Australia, as a young kid doing some, a lot of surfing and these kind of things. What was your first time that you got in contact with cycling?
So when I was young, when I was like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, I rode a BMX around. I got a BMX for my birthday when I was maybe 10, mm-hmm. started riding that around with my mates and, you know, just like enjoying being on the bike. Like bike riding always offers, obviously the sort of cliches of it offers autonomy and freedom and adventure and all of these things. And so I would just ride around my local neighborhood in the park on the BMX. And then when I was, but then I kind of stopped and got into surfing when I was in my teens. So like 13, 14, 15, I was surfing. And then when I was 17 or 18, I got interested in bike riding again. I can't remember exactly how, but I was working at a skate shop. Actually, now I think about it, I do know how. I was working at a skate shop. A guy at the skate shop, an older guy, had bought a really cool mountain bike. And I was like, this thing is insane. Like I've never seen a bike like it. And so it started getting me thinking about that. So I started riding my BMX around again when I was like 16. And then I started looking into mountain biking. So because I saw this guy's mountain bike and I was like, I want one of those. So I started looking into mountain biking, learned about that. And then started riding. And then eventually I did get a mountain bike and I started riding the mountain bike around when I was like 18. But what was interesting was that I started working in a bike shop. Eventually when I was 18, I started working in a bike shop. Okay. And I started commuting on my mountain bike to the bike shop. And the commute was like 25 or 30 kilometers each way.
Wow.
Yeah. And I did it like every day, not quite every day, but a lot of days a week.
Yeah.
And I was riding a dual suspension cross-country mountain bike on the road only all the way across Sydney to go to this bike shop. And what I found was interesting was that on my days off, eventually I started taking the mountain bike out for road rides. And I just found that I loved riding on the road. And then it twigged and I was like, if I'm riding a mountain bike on the road, I'm not taking it off road. What am I doing? Why don't I get a road bike?
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, so I like, luckily the shop I was working at was like, yeah, you can have a bike on like a long-term invoice. So I picked out a bike and started riding this road bike. And what was most telling for me, like I think in life you have these moments of like, you have such an internal deep gut feeling of like, yes, I'm meant to be doing this. And from the second I got the road bike, like the day I got it, all I could think about was racing. It was really strange. Like I'd never considered road racing at all. And from the day I got the road bike, I was like, I have to go as fast as on this thing as I can possibly go. And I want to race. And so I started racing on the road. Like I'd ridden on the road bike for like literally a couple of 2 months maybe. And I was like I didn't even know how to corner properly, you know, on a road bike. And I was like, I've got to race. So I signed up and did like a criterium and then like got obsessed with that. And so, yeah, so that was pretty, I was a little bit older now I think about it once I was doing that. It was like 19, 20. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just was obsessed. And it was so seamless for me to go from being like someone who didn't ride a bike to riding a mountain bike to riding a road bike and racing. That transition felt really natural and really straightforward.
It's a pretty cool story though, because most of the time it's just like, yeah, my dad used to do it, or my mom or my friends or something like this. But to see someone having a really cool bike, and that's where dreams are starting, you know, something like this. It's pretty cool, actually. And
it took some inspiration.
Yeah, but did you also at one point like start to follow like cycling on TV or like internet or these kind of things? Or because you told it, I want to race, I want to do this. And eventually you probably start to get better and better, and you're getting more, how do you call it, like professional about it as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask, actually. That's one thing I didn't mention. So around the time when I was riding the mountain bike across Sydney to the job, it was July. So it was the Tour de France time. So I did actually watch some stages of the tour and didn't really understand it at all. But then I very quickly, like my brain twigged into what the different jerseys meant. I understood, like when I first started watching it, I had no idea where any of the jerseys were or how it worked. But then my brain was like, that must mean, like no one explained it to me. I kind of just figured it out. Like that must mean that, okay, that guy's in, you know, the polka dot jersey. That's why he's going for the climb. Like that's why he's going as hard as he can at the top of the climbs. Mm-hmm. And I sort of, and then I would just listen to the commentary. So yeah, so I did sort of initially have that period of like, oh, the Tour de France looks really cool. You know, these guys go really fast. The jerseys are interesting, you know, all this sort of thing.
This is, I'm thinking about it. Was this also the time, it's about like 15, 16 years ago now, I think.
Yeah, when Cadel.
Exactly, Cadel. Yeah. Was this the time that Cadel was really at the top and eventually won Tour de France as well?
Yeah, so I watched the first tour I ever watched. Actually, that's a different topic, but when I first came to Europe, I came to Europe for a bit when I was 18, and I did go and watch the Tour de France with some friends, but they wanted to go, I didn't want to go. Okay. And we ended up on Alpe d'Huez. I didn't even know what Alpe d'Huez was at the time. I was 18. And so I had no idea how iconic Alpe d'Huez was, but Cadel came past and it was when he was second overall.
No way. I was there at the top of Alpe d'Huez as well.
Were you? Yeah, that's so funny. On Dutch Corner?
No, not on Dutch Corner, but at the top of the very top, like 1K from the top or something like that. Oh, I was thinking about before you were talking about it. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Interesting. Small world.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was there. So I watched Cadel come past, didn't even know who Cadel Evans was. Funnily enough, I rode with him just the other day, like, you know, we rode together a couple of months ago. Yeah. Because he's still with BMC. And so, yeah, so I watched him come past. That was a cool experience, but I didn't think too much of it.
Mm-hmm. I remember all the Australians were like, yell for Cadel.
They've got some sayings. Yeah. But yeah, so I watched that and it was actually not that kind of made me excited. But then 2 years later, Cadel did win. Mm-hmm. But I was already a road cyclist when Cadel won, but a very new road cyclist by that stage. But it was cool to have, an Australian obviously win the Tour de France. I didn't realize the serious nature of it, as in like how important that was. The thing about Australia is that the general public doesn't really pay attention to cycling. So it was difficult in Australia to like be in this sport, to have this person achieve this feat that's like never been done before. And the general public was like annoyed that he didn't live in Australia, not the general public, but like people, like journalists were like, you know, who wanted to be critical were like, oh yeah, but he doesn't even live in Australia. So like, you know, they wanted yeah, there was pushback from people who were like, you know, what has he done for society? He doesn't even live here and all this stuff. So yeah, that stuck with me. And that's also, that plays into a larger story of why I eventually moved to Europe.
Yeah, because that's the next thing I was talking about. Maybe skipping a few years or parts to talk about, but it's like, why did you quit Australia eventually and move here, move to Europe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it's a long story and there's lots of different moving parts to it. Yeah. But yeah, a big part of the mental side of the move was that as a bike rider, I didn't feel, especially living in Sydney, I didn't feel that I could I fit. Like, cycling in Australia in general is a niche sport, and then, and it's growing. It definitely is growing. And within the cycling world in Sydney, or in, sorry, in Australia, it's like really, really popular. People absolutely love it. There's good races. There's, you know, heaps of bunch rides. Like, there's nothing wrong with the cycling culture in Sydney, specifically where I'm from, but the general public's opinion of cycling is different in Australia. So I found that you always feel like an outsider. I would go out for a ride and I'd come home and feel like not only like my life had been threatened multiple times by cars, but just that you're just not wanted. So when I came to Girona on holiday and found that cycling was so accepted here, it gave me a sense of like complete just acceptance. I just felt like I fit into society much better here. So yeah, that was what motivated me to want to move. But yeah, there's some other parts that I can tell you about why, sure. You know, how the steps came into place. But yeah, so Australia is like such a great country, but as a cyclist, it's very difficult.
I'm willing to or want to talk about like why specifically Girona and these parts, you know, in a short while. I wanted to jump a little bit on a different topic. Is like your like. Creativity and photography and videography. How did you get into it? It's like, first question what pops in mind is like, where do you get your creativity from? Where does it come from?
I think I couldn't tell you like chemically or biologically. Like my mom when she was sort of younger was a professional viola player, so she was a professional musician in her 20s. But then my grandfather and my dad were both really into photography. My grandfather was a professional photographer, and he did like medical photography. All right. And then my dad, while he wasn't a professional photographer, he always worked in film and television and video. And so maybe that was like passed down, but also it really came from just looking at stuff. Like when I was a kid and when I was a teenager, I watched so many, again, surfing and skate videos and read so many magazines. I had piles of magazines, like the height of my wall, full of magazines.
With cool photos.
Yeah. And for me, it was always just about, like, I liked writing, like as in journalism style writing a bit, but it was always the visual. It was always the aesthetic. Like it was always what I could see with my eyes that got me excited rather than what I read on a page. So when I had these magazines, I just flipped through them. And eventually the magazines turned to watching DVDs, surfing DVDs and skate DVDs and watching videos of people doing this thing. And just the aesthetic, like the literally what I could see became it like permeated my brainwaves. And so then when I would go to like the beach, I started to like see it and be like, I want to capture that because I've seen that on a screen and that's been really inspiring. And I want to recreate my own version of that. So the inspiration, I think the way I got creative was just purely by being inspired.
Yeah.
So
and how did you do that and start out with, because everybody starts out somewhere, but how did you start out with like the photography part?
When I started riding a mountain bike, when I was like 15, 16, 17, my mates were better than me. And so because I was being so inspired by what I was seeing, I was riding mountain bikes and I'd obviously had this background with surfing videos and surfing and everything. So I started kind of combining the two. Like I'd go out and ride with my mates. They were better than me. And I thought, well, if they're better than me, what can I do that's like something different? And so I would start taking photos. So I had a little digital camera that I just carried around. I can't even remember where I got it. Like I found it, my parents had it, something or other. Started taking some photos and then quite enjoyed that. And then sent them to my mates and they were like, oh, this is sick. Like, can you do more? So then I just started doing more. And then when I was more like 17, my parents got a proper camera, like our first family, you know, the good family camera.
Yeah.
It was an old Nikon. It was a D70, I think.
Usually always the father or the mother carries it, but now you are carrying it.
Yeah, exactly. So it was this like 2-megapixel DSLR. This is in 2004, 2005. And I started taking that around. And so then because you had manual controls on this camera, I could then like be more creative because I started to understand, okay, if I slow the shutter speed down, it does this. If I widen the aperture, it does this. So I started getting a bit more creative with like the camera control, not just what I was seeing, but then like, okay, how can I operate the camera to take a more interesting photo? And then it just grew from there. And then again, because I have a little bit of an obsessive personality, I just like started looking into like, okay, what more can I add? What gear can I buy? Not just gear can I buy because I like, spending money. I do like spending money on gear, but it's probably why I like triathlon. But more like, what can I buy to make my photos even better? So then I started buying remote flashes and things that like other people were not using. So yeah. It was like, okay, I can use my, you know, the remote flashes to create and shape light and take photos that look even more interesting. And then it's like anything, the better you get, the more you want to get better. So as I felt the feeling of progress, I got more obsessed. And so over the course of maybe 12 or 18 months, I started to get really, really obsessed. And then pretty quickly, I think I was quite lucky. I shared some photos on a mountain bike website. It was like a forum online, and an editor of a magazine reached out to me. And he was like, hey man, like, we really like your photos. Would you be interested in featuring some photos in a magazine? And I was like, hell yeah. Like, I've read magazines my whole life.
This was almost like your child dream, right?
It fully was. And I never, ever in my wildest dreams thought that I would be published in a magazine. And then the editor reached out to me. I didn't even send him the photos. He said to me, would you like to have some photos published? And I was like, for sure. And he's like, just send us like everything you've got and we'll choose some photos. And in that first magazine, I thought I might get like a small photo in a corner. Mm-hmm. And they ended up publishing like a full page photo on one page, like a whole bunch of other photos throughout the magazine.
That must have been cool.
That just felt amazing. Yeah. Like opening that magazine when they sent it to me was just insane. Yeah. So yeah.
That must have been a cool feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the story goes that eventually you also start ending up doing a lot of wedding photography, right? Mm. I think I heard somewhere you've done over 200 weddings.
Yeah, maybe like 150 or 160, yeah.
But that still is like such a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about like how did, well, you talked a little bit already about like the mountain bike stuff, but how did it go from like wedding photography towards like now, like cycling kind of thing? But before that, I want to talk a little bit about like, you've got photography, but then you got videography and especially YouTube, these kind of things.
Mm.
YouTube has been around already for a long time. I think it's, you know, better than me, but 2010, 12-ish, something like this, maybe even earlier.
I think 2006, five.
It's been around already for a long, long time. But you only started out a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, I started out in 2021.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How did you go in 3 or 4 years? What is it? 4 years then now? Four and a half years? From starting out to having like 70,000 plus subscribers and videos with over 1 million views and these kind of things. How does it go so fast in a couple of years?
Oh man, again, it's one of these things where I'm trying to condense it in my head now so I don't like just talk for 20 minutes. YouTube's actually my favorite topic. I like talking about YouTube a lot because I'm still learning at it and it's still new to me, relatively new. You know, as you said, it's been around for a long time, almost 20 years, but I never used it. And what was interesting for me was that when I started creating videos for YouTube, I never watched YouTube. Like I started in 2021, but when we were in lockdown in 2020, I didn't even open YouTube. And I think YouTube would have been one of the biggest platforms that was used at that stage.
Yeah.
And I didn't even open it. So I think my monthly consumption of YouTube was like 5 minutes before I started a YouTube channel. So I'd never watched other people's videos. So I didn't really know what other people were creating online. But I think that gave me a little advantage because I just went and did my own thing rather than trying to recreate what other people were doing.
Yeah.
I took inspiration from those videos I was talking about as a teenager. But if we jump back just to like a moment, so I photographed weddings in Australia and I did photograph about 150 or so in Australia. And then when I moved to Europe, I was still photographing weddings. I did a couple. And luckily at that stage, I had then been taken to, like, I got flown to New York to photograph a couple of weddings.
Wow.
I went to Thailand to photograph a wedding. I went to Ireland. I've been in London, like photographed a couple of weddings in London. So I'd photographed around and then a couple here in Girona. And I'd photographed around and I had like a good body of work and I was a good photographer. But then when I arrived in Girona, people started asking me, oh, you ride and you take photos. Can you shoot cycling? And I was like, I could shoot cycling.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, I shot mountain biking years ago, but I just kind of stopped that because I didn't earn any money from it. And so, yeah, I was like, oh, I'll start shooting cycling. So I was shooting cycling. And then, but to get to the YouTube thing, what happened was I was shooting cycling photos, but then I was posting stories on my Instagram of my own rides, like my own, what I was doing, because I was riding with, you know, very good bike riders. I was riding in a beautiful place. I was training. And so I started publishing some photos on my stories. And then I started putting up like little video stories. Like one day I put up a little video story that was like a review of a helmet. That was just like a story, you know, it was a minute. And I was just like, oh, I got this new helmet. This is what I think of it. Don't know. I didn't really know why I was doing it, but the response that I had.
Sorry for interrupting, but did you have at that point like a massive following already, or?
I think I maybe had like 10 or 12,000 on Instagram.
Well, that's so quite a lot already.
It was good. Yeah. I mean, I was lucky. I had, like, when I was in Australia, I think I grew like a reasonable following pretty quickly in the earlier days of Instagram. And then, when I moved to Girona, then I think more people started picking up on what I was doing. You know, this sort of like, it's more common now, but like I was this Australian guy, I moved from Sydney to a small country town in Catalonia that like where the writing was amazing. And I was doing something that was maybe a little bit different to what people were doing back in 2017. So yeah, so then it grew. And then I had access to more, like, you know, I had lots of Spanish people start following me because I lived in the community. Then I had lots of people from the UK start following me. Then I had lots of people from the US start following me. So it was kind of a combination of like, as I left Sydney and expanded myself into the wider world also came to me from a following perspective. Mm-hmm. So I had a bit of a following there, and then that pretty quickly grew. And then, but I remember when I published this little helmet, it was 1 minute or 2 minutes helmet review. I had like a really overwhelming response from people being like, this is cool, do more of this.
All right.
And this was in 2019, I think, you know, or even, 2019. And I had more people say to me like, do more of this, do more of this. And so I was like, okay. And so I did a little bit more of my stories. And then eventually do I go into this story? In 2020, at the start of 2020, I started a separate Instagram account called TristanTake365. And I posted one photo every day for the whole year with a caption. And that became like a personal project. Like, okay, I have to post one photo every day to this Instagram account for the whole of 2020. And it was interesting through COVID and everything, because then I had to take all my photos in the apartment and
be creative as well.
And be creative. And just, it was something good to focus on throughout the time. And I started on the 1st of January and then I ended at the end, you know, the last day of the year. And I think I only went up maybe 500 followers, but it was a personal project for me. And so when I did that personal project, I then thought to myself, what's a personal project I can do for 2021? And I went, okay, I've done Instagram. Why don't I try YouTube? And again, I hadn't watched any YouTube, but I was like, why don't I do one video per week for 2021?
Wow.
Yeah, which at the time I thought that's pretty doable. You know, I was publishing a photo every day, like one video a week should be nothing. Very quickly realized, man, videos take so much longer than photos. So in 2021, the 1st of January, I published my first video. Like I made the video leading up to, I was in Andorra for Christmas with my friend Ben, and I made this video and then like published that on the 1st of January. And then a week later, published another one and then another one and then another one. And then I kept it going. I didn't quite do exactly one per week, but I did end up with 54 videos for the year. So I did like in August, I had a little break, but then in September I published like 5 or 6 videos. So it kind of... Yeah, so that was a real focus for me in 2021.
Is that also, and probably is, but that's also like the success formula of YouTube in general? Is like, first of all, you got to have quality content, right? I know. But to like keep going and keep posting and these kind of things and get new videos out all the time, you know, not once every 4 months or these kind of things, but like
all absolutely, the time. Absolutely. The number one formula with YouTube is like, consistency. Because you imagine if you approach it like a TV show, you know, people expect their favorite TV show to be 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And so if a YouTube channel publishes a video every single week, once people start watching it, they know, you know, especially if you say to the audience, because you can tell the audience anything, if you say, okay, I'm going to publish a video next Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, whatever it is, people then tune in for that episode. So you got to build a little bit of the like expectation. This is where my YouTube is tailed off, and I'm like, you know, I won't go into it, but like this year has been a little bit lower, the number of videos. But the first year I did 54, and it started, I think the reason I grew relatively quickly was not only because I tried to create quality content and unique content, but also just because I was very consistent. So I always say to people who are starting out with YouTube, like, focus on consistency for a while. You do need all the other elements, interesting shots, interesting stories, all of these characters, this sort of thing, but you need consistency first and foremost, so that at least you build up a bank of videos, even if in the second year, because in my second year, 54 videos my first year, I think my second year I only published 26 or 28.
Still a lot.
It was still a lot,
yeah.
But by that stage I had a bit of the audience, and then I started refining the content that I was making. So I wasn't just going out and writing and filming what I was doing. I was like coming up with concepts of like, okay, I want to do a bike review. I want to do a challenge. I want to do this. I'm going to do a trip. Yeah. I'm going to do a how-to video. So then I started refining the style of what I was making and starting to lean into what the audience was responding well to.
Last question about this part, because we got to move on as well. We've been talking quite a long time already and we still got a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
But it has been really cool so far. I'd ask this question, I think, as well to Bernard. You know Bernard? Mm. He's working at GCN España. They do a lot with YouTube, you know, and social media. But I asked this question to him as well. It's like, for them, for example, they have like new bike tech or this or tips for how you get started with cycling, these kind of things. But it's a little bit of the same question for you. Is it hard to come up with new ideas for content all the time?
I don't think so. I think cycling is a beautiful cycling, and then obviously triathlon are both beautiful sports. There's so many elements to them. You know, as you just said, there's training tips, there's, you know, tech reviews. There's so many moving parts with cycling. You can review races, you can talk to pros, you can get advice, you can talk about nutrition. So there's a never ending stream. It's almost too much. It's almost like, okay, you need to choose a niche within cycling. So like my niche became more the professional end and training tips and training how-tos, but some people's niche might be like beginner cycling tips. I've done some beginner cycling stuff because there's a big audience out there for that. But yeah, like, no, you never, never, ever run out of ideas. Right. And it's almost, you need to narrow those ideas down the entire time.
Cool. Girona.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Girona. You already talked about that a little bit, but I think 2017, 2018 is the time you moved over here.
2017, yeah.
All right, let's start out with the quick fire question, right?
Okay. Yeah.
First one we skip because since when are you living? What is your favorite place for coffee in Girona?
I really like Espresso Mafia. I've always done Espresso Mafia. I just think the location's great, coffee's great, and yeah, I think it's beautiful.
What is your favorite bike loop around there?
That's a hard one. I really love San Hilary, I call it the two sides of San Hilary. So you go out Santa Coloma, you go up the steeper side of San Hilary from Santa Coloma. Then when you get to the top, you turn left, go down the highway, down to Arbucias. Mm-hmm. You turn right and then you come up
again,
that next side of it back up to the top. I think that's great. And then if you want to extend it out even further, when you're going down, so then you go down the flatter side down to Osor. And then when you get to Osor, you turn left and climb the Col de Nafre, which is up above the dam, and then come back down, do the rest from Osor back down to Angles and then back to Girona. That's a loop that I've done like a lot of times, and I think it's still my favorite loop.
Nice. This is maybe a question for only since like a year, maybe longer, I don't know. Do you prefer running on Vías Verdes or trail running on El San Gels?
I've done way, way more. Like I've only run on El San Gels a couple of times, literally a couple of times, which is almost embarrassing. But I've only also been into running for a short period. Mm-hmm. I run on the Via Verde because I like flat running and it's like bike riding where I like going fast. So I like the consistency. A lot of people love the outdoors nature of running. For me, it's more about like I actually love looking at times and like being really consistent with that kind of thing. So I think running in the trails is more fun, but running on the Via Verde is more training, and that hits a certain thing for me.
Have you been to a Girona football game before?
Yes, once years ago, but I haven't been since they qualified. Well, now they're not. I don't think they're in it anymore. But yeah, I have. Yeah, really cool experience.
What's your favorite restaurant in Girona?
I love Plaza del V7. Well, it was called Plaza del V7. I think it's just now called V7, just in Plaza del V. It's a very typically Catalan, but the wine menu is awesome. It's like very nice without being pretentious. And yeah, again, the wine list is great. So yeah.
What do you dislike most about Girona?
Well, that's a really hard one. I don't think there's anything I specifically dislike about Girona at all. I wish I lived closer to the pool. to me, everything in Girona is positive. You know, I could sit here like anyone and complain about, there's so many influences or there's so many this or that.
Yeah.
But like at the end of the day, I'm a part of that community. I like can't complain about it.
What are the things you like the most then about Girona?
I love the size. I think the physical size is honestly spot on. It's a town with a big enough population that's interesting, but a small enough population that you don't feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You can walk down the street and bump into people, but equally you can get out really fast. Mm-hmm. When I drive back into Girona, like coming home, you can be on the outskirts of town and then you're in Girona within like 10, 15 minutes. Like that's amazing for a city that offers or a town that offers so much. You can get from the outside to the inside to the old town really, really easily and quickly. I live just on the edge of the old town and I can be in the old town in 5 minutes walk. And equally I can ride my bike and be on El San Gels in 8 minutes. Yeah. So nice, yeah. It offers this perfect balance for me. I think it's such a great size that every time I think about Girona, I look around for other places that I might want to move in the future. And everywhere I look is either a bit too big or a bit too small. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I love Girona from that perspective.
Do you have in the last 8 years you've been here, do you have a hidden gem in Girona? Something people visiting Girona or live here, they should definitely do or visit?
Oh, I can't tell you that one.
No.
I mean, there's so many things. Yeah. It depends what you want. You know, I think going to, I think going out to the coast, I think it's always worth going. If people are coming here on a holiday, I say don't just stay in Girona. Go and spend, have a night on the Costa Brava somewhere. A town I would really recommend people to go to would be Calais de Palafrugell. Palafrugell is a beautiful little town on the coast. I went there for my anniversary with Natalie the other day, and it's just it's almost like a Girona on the coast, where it's like a small place that's quiet, but there's good vibes there. There's lots of people around when it gets busy, but then you can kind of get out quite quickly and easily.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Has Girona changed much in the last 8 years?
Yeah, a lot. But interestingly, it has.
Is it now different than when you came here, for example?
It is. It's more gentrified. It's more like when I first moved, it was a bit of an uncut gem. It was a bit rough around the edges. Whereas now it's got, you know, obviously we have more nice cafes, we have more nice restaurants. There's definitely a feeling of wealth in town that there wasn't before. You know, I see more, just from a visual standpoint, I see more people walking around in nicer clothes. It feels more refined. I won't say whether that's a good or a bad thing, but it's different to how it was. But having said that, it's not so different that it's unrecognizable. It's still got the same heart, you know, the same place. It's just got more people in it now. And yeah.
Yeah. How did you find Girona? This was already something we were bumping into long time ago in the Witness podcast, but that's where we stopped at that moment about talking about Girona. But how the hell do you go from Sydney, Australia to a small city town in Catalonia?
I'll go through this one real quick, but basically my girlfriend that I was with in Sydney back in 20, we were together for a number of years, mm-hmm. and then we broke up in 2016. She won a flight to Madrid. Yeah, very random. She won a flight to Madrid that she had to give to another person. It was part of a competition with Flight Center. Shout out to Flight Center, because they're not a sponsor of mine, but they were what got me to Girona. She applied for this competition through Flight Center online. She won this flight to Madrid, but she couldn't use it, so she gave it to me. She had to give the flight to someone else as a gift. It was coming up to Christmas. So she gave the flight to me to Madrid, and she said, "You've always wanted to ride your bike in Europe. Take this, you know, flight." She couldn't come because she had university. It had to be in certain days. So she's like, go to Madrid, go to Europe, go and ride your bike. So I didn't know where to go, and I'd always wanted to ride my bike in the Pyrenees. And so I flew to Madrid, and then I caught a train up. And when I was in Sydney, a few days before I left, someone said to me, "You have to go to this town. If you're on your way to the Pyrenees, go to this town called Girona." I'd never even heard of Girona at the time. And so I caught a train up to Girona and got an Airbnb with a guy who I'm still friends with now, and came here just on holiday. And I was meant to be going to the Pyrenees. And then I got here and I was meant to spend a week here. And I ended up spending 2.5 weeks here because I loved it so much. I didn't go anywhere else. And yeah, I just fell in love with the town. And so that was in 2015. And then a year later, she and I broke up. And then I came back for another holiday because I enjoyed it so much and spent another 2 weeks here and loved it. And then I thought to myself, you know what? I can move anywhere in the world. I had that freedom of just because she and I broke up. And then, you know, I was like, I've got that freedom to go wherever I want in the world. And I thought, I've got a British passport. So I could live in Europe at that stage, pre-Brexit. Mm-hmm. So I was like, why don't I just try moving to that town that I loved riding my bike in? I can go and be a bike rider for a while, see what it's like. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have plans to be here for as long as I've been here. And then I thought I will get a bit of time there, see what it's like. And then it just carried on. And now I've been here for this long. So, and then I got my residency, for people who are always like, "Oh, but how do you live there now?" So I got my residency in 2020. And so when Brexit kicked in, I had to get residency. Mm-hmm. So I got my residency, sorted all of that out, and yeah, sort of been here ever since.
Cool story.
Yeah.
Fun. Talk a little bit more about, we're getting towards triathlon and Ironman kind of thing. But before that, I want to talk shortly about like ultra endurance events. Like you've done Atlas Mountains. You've done, what is it called again? El Piri.
Yeah.
You've done Badlands.
Yep.
These kind of, and you've done a couple of more, but what are these events like?
I haven't
done anything like this, like 800 kilometers in 1 or 2 days or these kind of things, you know, or I haven't done this. So I know the feeling of a triathlon or an Ironman, but I don't know this feeling like that. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's an interesting physical experience and like mental experience because it's so much more like you're not, it's not just an event, like you're living it, you know, like you go and do it, you know, like when I did the 70.3, you're on for like 4 hours, 5 hours, mm-hmm. but then with, or a full distance, maybe you're on for 8, 9, 10 hours, you know, or longer. But like with an ultra, you're actually living, like it's the morning, the day, the afternoon, the evening, the night, overnight, early morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, like you have to live through the experience. So it's more of an entire experience. You can't clock in and then clock out. Mm-hmm. You have to be on.
You have to live.
Even if you do decide to stop and sleep in a hotel, you're still in the race mindset. So you still know, okay, I've got to wake up. I've got to be quick with my whatever I'm doing. If you're trying to race it, you know, for me, I'm always trying to race because I'm a racer. So like all the ultras I've done, I like have slept as little as possible. And so that means your adrenaline is switched on, you know, your adrenal gland, like you're switched on the entire time. So it's a more completely encompassing event. They're incredibly challenging, but like, and I don't even know if I would say incredibly rewarding, but there's a certain level of reward that you get from doing that that you can't get anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You can't get the same reward, you know, doing a 70.3 that you'd get from an ultra.
It's maybe the, talking about rewards, is maybe the reward for like such an event, like an ultra endurance cycling event, is it maybe the reward also the experience?
For sure. Yeah, you do it for the experience. You know, there's no awards, there's no... there's definitely no prize money. There's no anything for the mm-hmm. person who finishes first in ultras. And it's not even about that. Like most ultras are more, they're designed. Okay, yes, you have a winner. There's a bit of fanfare around the winner, but like they're designed for people to go and have an experience. And I think a lot of sports these days are, but in most sports, we still celebrate the winner. Whereas in ultras, what I really love is like, I want to celebrate the person who finishes an ultra in 8 days because they've been out there for so long experiencing so much. Like when I did El Piri, I finished in 56 hours. So like that was, well, I don't know whether it was fast or slow because it was the first year it was run. It's actually about to start in the next, I think it starts very soon.
Cool. That's starting from Girona, right?
It's starting from Girona. Yeah. So
finishing here as well?
It finishes here as well. Yeah. So, you know, I did El Piri in 56 hours, so 2.5 days or 2 and a bit days, which was like, I think it was a good time. You know, I think the time will come down this year. But then I was really more impressed with the people who did it in like six, seven days because, or 5 or 6 days, because you're out there experiencing for so much longer. And when you talk about living through an experience, like you can live more mm-hmm. in 7 days than you can live in 2 days. Mm-hmm. So people who take longer often experience more, live more. And I think that should be celebrated with the ultra thing.
Nice, so, cool perspective. Yeah. We could have been talking like hours about ultra endurance kind of things, and it's for sure maybe for another podcast sometime. I don't know.
Yeah.
But tell me before we go on to the triathlon part, eventually as well, about your journey to like starting running, because you've been doing cycling all the time, and why the hell did you start running at some point?
That's a very big. I gotta give a big shout out to Natalie for that one. I mean, obviously living in Girona, you're surrounded by runners anyway.
Yeah.
And people are running here, and you know, I go out on the bike and I see people running. You climb up Hells Angels on the road, you see people running on the trails next mm-hmm. to you and that kind of thing. And like all my friends run and you know, that sort of thing. But the catalyst was when I met Natalie. She was a triathlete already. And so she was training she did La Quinta in the US and then she did Oceanside. And so she was training and I was, you know, leaning into the fact that she was a triathlete and sort of, I had never had any interest in being a triathlete, but I was like, okay, like, you know, starting to fall in love with this person, you know, she's amazing and she's doing this other thing that I don't do.
Yeah.
And so we went for a run together one day and I came home after, I remember it like specifically, I think we did 4.6 kilometers at 6 minutes and 9 seconds per kilometer.
Mm-hmm.
And after 4.5 Ks at 6 minutes per kilometer, I couldn't walk for a week. And it was this incredible feeling of like, holy shit, you're an absolute novice at this. Like you are so beginner at this, it's unreal. And then, because I obviously was spending more and more time with Natalie, then, you know, I was like, oh, I want to, you know, try this thing again. I like being a beginner. I like progressing. And it was actually really eye-opening to be like, oh, you're an absolute beginner at this, but how well can you improve? So then when I went to the US last year for 10 weeks to be with Natalie, because she was living in California at the time, we, you know, started running together a little bit. And then I started progressing a bit at that. And then I started getting a bit obsessed because I felt like I knew everything I needed to know about cycling, whereas running, I was right at the start. So I started looking into shoe reviews and all of this sort of thing. And I was in Santa Monica with Natalie because she was living in Santa Monica. And Santa Monica is a beautiful place to run. You've got the beach, you've got like the paths around. You know, you've got all of the Palisades, which unfortunately now are all burnt down. But we ran around the Palisades, and it feels quite special now that we had this period, Natalie and I, running around the Palisades near where she lived, because she absolutely loved that area. Mm-hmm. And we would go and run and like look at the houses and sort of talk. And we just had this like really beautiful period of running around Santa Monica while I was there for 10 weeks. And just a combination of like my own obsession with the progress that I felt with running got me more and more into it. And then I had this idea that like before I leave Santa Monica, I have to do a half marathon like as quick as I can, basically. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had this idea, like, let me train up to try and do a half marathon. So with about 2 weeks before I left, Natalie and I went and did a half marathon. We just ran around the Palisades and it was awesome. We did it pretty like socially and it was really nice. And then a week later, I went and was like, let me run a flat half marathon on the beach path in front of the beach.
But coming from like 4 point whatever k's that you just talked about, two and a half marathon is pretty big.
Yeah, in 10 weeks I was pretty happy with it. So then I went and did a 129 half, which for me was like it was a stretch, you know, as a push to get there, but I was really happy with how I did. And if you look on my Strava, you can see like I negative split the whole thing. Every kilometer got faster, basically. Every kilometer got faster. So I feel like I ran it in the right way, and that was when I really, after I did that, I felt particularly proud, and that was when I was like cementing the like, yeah, I want to keep running, because that feeling of progress in the sport is something that I'm no longer feeling in cycling. I still get a lot of passion and a lot of enjoyment out of cycling and going and hitting numbers that I can do, but I'm doing less new stuff on the bike, whereas running was really new, and Santa Monica was a beautiful place to like learn how to do this new thing and have this whole new experience, so... Yeah. Yeah, big shout out, obviously, to Natalie for like sort of getting me into it.
But that's probably as well, like where you get more a little bit more and more into triathlon as well. I think, right?
For sure, for sure. Yeah. And she was swimming, and so like when she was swimming, she was running, she was riding. I was then like, okay, you know, we talked about it a bit, and I got a bit obsessed. I think she got annoyed with how quickly I got obsessed with it. But then, yeah, she would go to the pool, so I started going to the pool, and so yeah, I started swimming, and then it was like, okay, maybe there's some avenue there to try to compete in a new sport. And then I started looking at results, and then it all, you know, and started looking at races, and then it just spirals from there, man. You know, you start getting a bit obsessed with something, and then all of a sudden I'm like staying up watching YouTube videos of like whatever race was on at the time. And then I was lucky. So I work with Peloton. Like Peloton is a sunscreen brand, and it's run by my old flatmate who I used to live here. He's a very good mate of mine, Tom. And
Tom Austin.
So Tom with Peloton, because Peloton is, we work with, when I say we work, Peloton is one of my sponsors, but I help with content creation and things like this, and just helping grow the brand because it's run by a friend of mine, and it's such a great product. I was using it as a customer for years before I, like in 2018, I started using Peloton as a customer and I was buying it. And then I became friends with Tom and I was like, oh man, you run this brand that I buy the product and I love it. Especially coming from Australia, where sunscreen is really important, to have like a really good sports sunscreen here in Europe.
It's important here in Girona as well.
Yeah, it's very important here. So I had this opportunity. Tom was like, do you want to come and we're photographing the Norwegians? So Christian and Gustav, actually in Font-Rémy.
Last year.
Yeah. So we went up there and photographed them for a day and hung out with them. And that was cool. And like, it's so funny. I'm hanging out with like two of the best triathletes in the world with a vague interest in triathlon, asking them silly questions like, oh, how fast do you run when you're doing a recovery day? You know, but and they were probably rolling their eyes. It's probably like going and hanging out with Pogacar or something and being like, oh, what's your FTP? But then like, I just remember being like, wow, these guys are super cool, super nice. Those guys are absolute legends. And we just had such a great day and it got me more interested in triathlon. So there's all these elements where I was like, oh, this is starting to come together now. And it started to put me on a different trajectory.
Yeah. So. What was it, the moment that you signed up for your first 70.3?
It was right at Christmas or maybe New Year's. It was this thing where, like, you know, the classic, like, it's almost cliche, like, oh yeah, new year, new me. Like, I'd thought about, Natalie and I had discussed it and I hadn't really pinpointed one that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we got to like New Year's Day. She signed up for Ironman Barcelona and I signed up for 70.3 Rapperswil in Switzerland. Yep. And I thought 6 months because it was in June, so that was the start of the year. And then I thought, you know, 1st of June is a good amount of time to be able to train and learn what I need to learn. And I'd been doing some running and I'd done a faster half by that stage. I hadn't done any road races, like running races, but I went out and did a half marathon on the Carrelet really fast that like ruined my knees. But it was just something I needed to do. I needed to be like, okay, what, like I trained for 10 weeks, did a half marathon, and then like what I considered that was fast for me, you know, and then a couple of months later, I was like, let me go and do like a fast half marathon on the Carrelet on the Via Verde, see what I can do. So I did that, but then got a bit injured. But anyway, the long story is, yeah, 1st of January, I did the sign up for
typical thing.
Typical. Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
How has the, because, and then we come on to the race, but how has these months of preparation towards, well, it's your first triathlon in general, and half is pretty long. It's a pretty big one. Maybe not if you have been like doing ultras like you have done, but you know yeah. what I mean? Still a long day out.
Yeah.
How has the preparation as like a completely beginner, how has it been?
Really, really good. I was really happy with how I prepared. I mean, I did get a little bit injured in January. I was running and I just was running too fast. Yeah. Typical runner running, like typical new runner, ran too fast. Of course, because of my years of endurance background with cycling, like my heart rate and my legs just don't match up, so I can run, you know, like I can run at a very high heart rate
sure.
for a long period of time.
Your muscles,
no
your tendons and your joints, these kinds are not used to the pounding impact all the time.
Yeah, people said to me, like, they're like, you got to think of yourself like a car. You've got the engine, you don't have the suspension. Mm-hmm. So exactly. I needed to build the suspension. So, but yeah, I loved, like, I fully self-coached for the triathlon and just using training philosophies I understand in terms of, you know, basic fitness and how to get fitter at things. And I also just believe in the real basic like aspect of, if you want to get good at something, you just have to do it a lot of times. There is a true element to that. And like, it's, you know, you're a coach, so you'll have more ideas of it than I do. But
I'm going to be helping Natalie towards, I remember Barcelona.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we'll see how good your coaching is.
Exactly.
But for me, it was just like swimming, I just need to do it more. I'd never, you know, even though I grew up surfing, I'd never swum laps of a pool or done any laps of a beach or anything like that. So it was just like, let me just get in the pool, do a bunch of laps. I'll surely progress in some way. And I did. Running, it was the same. After I kind of injured myself trying to do it fast, you know, trying to run too fast, I was then like, okay, tone it back. Mm-hmm. Just like start with the basics, just jogging, just get that done. And then I did a lot of my fitness building on the bike. Mm-hmm. So that was a big one for me. Someone said to me, my friend Andrew, who's actually also a coach, he said to me, like, go and do all your fitness work on the bike because your body can handle that. And that fitness will translate. Like, I'm never going to go and run a 1:15 half marathon at the end of a bike ride in a triathlon. He was just like, just go and, you know, do what you can do on the bike and then just jog so your body gets used to building that sort of suspension. Did a bit of strength work, which I'd never done before, and that was cool. And then just learned to juggle time management. That's the biggest one.
Yeah.
The time management for triathlons.
Suddenly there's not one sport you have to do, but three sports. Well,
totally.
In a way, with like the gym work, four.
Yeah. Four, and then nutrition is fifth. Wow. You know, there's more to it, which appeals to my brain. I wish I was a proper pro triathlete so I could dedicate all my time to it. Mm-hmm. Because then, of course, you're juggling like work and social life and personal life and everything around it. It's time consuming.
I know. So last week, now already a week ago, time flies.
Mm-hmm.
70.3 Switzerland, 70.3, what is it called? Jona Rapperswil, I think.
Rapperswil Jona.
Amazing race, I think. Crazy fast time. What did you end up finishing for?
Oh, for me, man, it's always that thing where I'm like, oh, I didn't go that fast, but because you see people in front of you. I did 4:16.
4 hours 16 for your first half.
Yeah. But it was on a the bike course was hilly. Like it was over a thousand meters.
That's a lot for like a half. It's pretty tough. But super fast, I think. Actually really, thanks, really man. Cool. Really good race. Even a qualification for the 70.3 World Championships. Was that something you were expecting or thinking about, or not at all?
Yeah, okay, yeah. I mean, I can't deny. You always go to these events. Yeah. I had in my mind, like, that would be awesome. And I said it to Natalie, and part of the reason I like the idea of qualifying for the 70.3 Worlds is because when I look through the calendar, so many Ironman events are sold out. Mm. You just can't even get an entry to a lot of them. And they keep getting emails being like, this one sold out, this one sold out, this one's. And I knew, okay, with Worlds, it's a guaranteed, like if you qualify, you get to go. Yeah. It's not like any other race where it might just sell out. And so, yeah, that was a big, nice. It sat in the back of my mind, but it was almost that thought that I didn't want to allow it to be, mm-hmm. I wasn't going to say it to anyone mm-hmm. because I, you know, it's my first race. I don't know what to expect. I might fall apart on the run and do a 2-hour run or a 2:15 or something. Who knows? So I had it there, but then when it actually happened, that felt really, really cool.
Yeah. Before we talk about the elbow and the crash, there was one thing which was which I was laughing a little bit about. It's like whenever I saw the photos of you on your bike during the race, you had socks on.
Yeah, yeah.
you did felt too much like a cyclist still that you wanted to get your socks on the bike and I'm doing a triathlon but being a real triathlete. Like
no. For me, the socks must stay on the bike.
It's actually getting more and more people like doing already the socks on after the swim.
Really?
But then like aero socks and these kind of things, you know. Yeah.
I had Hoob send me some calf guards, some really nice calf guards. You know, they're really fast calf guards. But the only thing for me is I just can't bring myself to ride the bike without socks because I know I've got to put them on at some point.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not gonna sacrifice the 10 seconds it takes. You know, and so I was like, I'm either going to put them on before the ride or before the run. So I may as well put them on before the ride, get photos I like the look of and feel like myself. And also because I haven't ridden without socks before, I didn't want to just try riding without socks straight away.
Some stupid things going on.
Like I know that my shoes fit me well with socks. Yeah. So, yeah.
So the crash. You, because again, you finished in an amazing fast time. And well, first of all, you finished, but amazing fast time as well. But you crashed shortly before transitioning towards running. And not like an easy or like a small crash or whatever, but you fractured your elbow.
I replayed it over in my head so many times. And like the first thing I'll say is it was my fault. It was just a stupid mistake. But basically what happened was I was coming along. I'd done basically all of the bike. There was a feed zone with 3 kilometers to go. And my thinking was coming through that feed zone, I was like out of nutrition by that stage. But because it was 3Ks to go, I was like, that was my plan. You know, I finished my last water bottle maybe 2 minutes before, or I finished the last bit of water on the bike. And then so I was like, my plan is to get a bottle at the last feed zone, drink the entire thing in the last 3Ks, and then I would be ready for the run. So coming through the feed zone, I was looking for someone to get a bottle from, and the volunteers obviously hold out the bottles. And I was riding through, and admittedly, I was riding too fast. Like this is not, I won't put it on anyone else. It was my fault. I'm happy to take the blame. But I was riding through, I saw this woman holding out a water bottle. I reached to grab it. And as I reached to grab it, like I lifted one hand off the handlebars and I started looking at the bottle. So I was looking to my right. And as I like reached and grabbed the bottle and I looked forward, there was a woman on the bike in front of me and she was basically stopped. And like I didn't see her coming. Like it must have happened so fast that basically I don't know if she stopped to grab a bottle or she slowed, but like I came up on her so quick that there was no chance I could stop. And I had one hand off the bars and I just like impacted her. Like I ran into her, well, overlapped and then like ran into her. I went over the top. We both went kind of flying. She landed on top of me, which was good because I felt so bad. I wanted to break her fall. Yeah. Luckily no issues with the bikes. She wasn't injured. She got back up and she was fine. And I just apologized profusely cause I felt so bad. And it was just one of those typical triathlon mistakes where coming from a world of bike racing where everyone travels at the same speed, you don't expect someone to be stopped in the way. And again, it's my fault. I should be aware of that kind of thing, but yeah, that's how it happened. So I've like plowed into her. I plowed into the ground, had a brand new helmet on and just like hit the helmet. The helmet did an amazing job of, you know, saving me. Smash the helmet, or at least, you know, like I'm pretty sure it's pretty smashed. So that's a write-off. But then I got up, my elbow was pretty sore, but I made sure that the woman was okay. She was fine. She got back on the bike. Like the volunteers helped her. She started riding again. I got on my bike, made sure it was all good. And then I rode to the finish, but I couldn't really put my arm in the aero bars for the last 3Ks. So I just rode in, and so I don't know how much time I lost. I lost, you know, a little bit of time. But then, yeah, I got to the finish of the bike and was pretty sore, like getting my shoes off, like coming up to the transition zone, like getting my shoe, because I did like slip my feet out, reaching down to push with my right hand to get my foot out of the shoe was like really hard. And I was like, oh man, this is not good. But then I was just full on race mode. I was like, get this thing done. Like you have to get in. Doesn't even matter if it takes you 5 minutes to put your shoes on, get the run done, like get out there and start running.
Was it painful with running? Doable.
It was doable. Yeah. And what's interesting is that when I went to the hospital and the doctor looked at it and like we did the x-ray, he said, okay, no riding, no swimming, but you can run. And so I was like, oh, that's cool. Like if I can run with a fractured elbow, that's why I could run during the race. Mm-hmm. But also just, you know, adrenaline and race mode. And I was like, I'm 2/3 of the way through this thing. I want to get it done. And I was, as much as I was fearful of the run, I was looking forward to running and seeing what I could do in like a proper race situation. So
there are like, and it's maybe one question or two questions in one. It's like, how did the triathlon experience, how was it different from ultra endurance events to like the triathlon itself? And what are some of the lessons you take from this event specifically, like both physically and mentally?
So with an ultra distance race, like an ultra off-road race or any kind of ultra race, you can never really ride, like you shouldn't be riding that hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be really consistent the entire way. You do get a bit slower throughout, but you want to start not too fast and you want to slow down not too much. But that's a low level. You know, you're riding like in after 24 hours in an ultra race, you're riding at zone one. Like you're not ever riding, mm-hmm. maybe on the climbs, you might be able to touch into zone two, but you're never riding zone three, zone four, because your body just doesn't have that capacity after such a long time. Whereas with the triathlon, it was a really like it, the appeal to me and what I really enjoyed about it was closer to a road race in terms of I could be at my own, or I could be at a higher physical capacity limit. So I rode the bike all at around like low zone three, but I had some spikes up into, you know, I need to look at my training peaks and see, but I think I would have spent maybe 20 or 30 minutes at zone four, particularly because there was 2 20-minute climbs in the course. So, and then like heart rate wise on the run, I was like always in the sort of zone three. So that's a higher capacity, but it's not like a road race where in a road race, the pace and the effort is being dictated to you by other people. As in you go up a climb, someone attacks, you have to respond to that attack. So that's when it's dictated to you. Whereas with triathlon, it's an entirely solo pursuit.
It's more pacing,
yeah. But it's at a speed that I like. I'm still a racer. You know, the thing that I don't like about ultras is that they are so slow. Whereas what I love about going faster is going faster. So then to answer your question about what I learned, obviously I learned that, you know, you have to always have your wits about you. You can't just be in, you know, maybe if you're at the front of the race on the bike, then, you know, you can be out there and not worry. But yeah, I had to be aware that on a 2-lap course, even if I was at the front, I was going to be passing people. So that was something that I had to learn. And I also learned, my bike riding is good. Like I set the 3rd fastest bike time overall for the day
with the crash.
With the crash. And I was 3rd fastest by only 2 minutes. Had I not had the crash, I think I would have been up there either fastest or 2nd fastest. I was fastest in my age group by 5 minutes on the bike. So it's like, okay, the bike riding is sorted. I just keep doing what I'm doing with the bike riding. The running and the swimming need work and the transitions need work. But it's really cool to have done a race to know, okay, like it's one thing to do training and be like, oh, I think I can do this. But then in a race, you're like, okay, I did that. So then I know going forward, mm-hmm. okay, I should be able to do a sub 30-minute swim, for example, yeah. because I did just over 30 minutes in this one and I was swerving around people the whole time, dodging people because I started so far back. Yeah. So these sorts of things that you can only get from a race are really good. And the other thing I'd say is that course was awesome. Like I'd recommend people go and do it. It's beautiful. It's really expensive in Switzerland. But like
steps on the run and this kind of thing, right?
Yeah, there was two each lap. You had to do like 57 steps up a little climb, which was tough. Slowed you down. But yeah, it was cool. It was nice.
I think earlier this year I did like experience some of the gravel events in Santa Val and Traca.
Yeah.
To me, the whole community and like before the race and the day before and these kind of things felt quite similar than triathlon. Was it a little bit the same for you as well?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. I really loved it.
People busy with tech and busy with bikes and busy with this and it's everybody is like still it's not only that pros, but everybody is out there for like having a good time and doing things and they are in the same boat sort of, you know?
Yeah.
It's cool, huh?
Yeah. It's really like Natalie always said to me when she got into triathlon, she realized how good the community was. And I can say that like even in the short time I've been into triathlon, the community's been amazing. And that's like the community in Girona, people I'm meeting, people, everyone I speak to. There's lots of people I've spoken to who I didn't know they did triathlon and I mm-hmm. mentioned that I'm doing triathlon. And they're like, oh, that's cool. I've done a few halves. And everyone's super positive, super welcoming, super, you know, fun to chat to about it. And on the race day, like everyone's in a good mood. It's always cool. You know, it's not, no one's rocking up with any, at least I felt, I didn't see anyone with any ego or anything. Everyone was like there to have a great time together. of course, with the organizations like Ironman does such a great, you know, you pay for it, but they do such a great job of creating a vibe, and, you know, the setup's amazing. Volunteers are super happy. All the competitors are like having fun together. And I think everyone understands that it's an individual challenge done with a collective group of people. Mm-hmm. You're not actually versing. Like, I wasn't looking at anyone being like, let me try and beat that guy. You know, it's like, whereas on the road, that's the way you feel.
Yourself. Yeah, but now you're battling with yourself as well.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So it was a really cool new experience. And yeah, the community aspect of it was awesome.
Nice. So next up, Marbella.
Yeah.
70x3 Worlds later this year. When is it? October? November?
8th and 9th of November.
November still. Cool.
Yeah.
It's a cool race. I've done it before, I think, in 2017.
Oh, cool.
Really quick race. Nice, yeah, nice race. Some hills and some climbs on the bike, but a lovely run alongside the beach as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
it's
awesome.
It's a cool event, but still a long way. Are you doing some trial in between as well, or is that going to be the next one?
I'll do a couple in between. Yeah, or maybe one in between. I need to see how my elbow heals up now. The doctor said like 4 to 6 weeks off, yeah. Or he said 6 weeks off, but like I think he was trying to have me not be back on the bike within 4 weeks. So
that was
that
a shitty situation, right? Because you were, after you did the race, you were in Switzerland for a couple of days longer for BMC.
Yeah.
And you were ambassador for BMC as well. And you had a couple of cool days with them, but you could not ride your bike.
Yeah, I was actually meant to be riding something new, yeah. With BMC as part of a sort of something that's coming up with BMC. So yeah, and I didn't get to ride. So I ended up hanging out, but there was a whole bunch of journalists there who were riding. So I ended up hanging out with them and photographing and, yeah, it was a shame to be, you know, to plan this trip where I was doing the race, then I was going to be with BMC for a few days in the mountains. But then the weather was pretty bad and, you know, so the journalists were going out riding in the rain. And so I got to enjoy the downtime. And as I said before, once I came to grips with it and I just was like, okay, I'm injured now, you kind of lean into that and that's fine. So
next year, full Ironman?
Oh, I don't know. That's a hard one. I think I want to see Natalie do hers,
yeah.
And I want to do a few more of my own. The reason I like the 70.3 distance for me is like it's such a great, at least for where I'm at right now, it's such a great, like doable, achievable thing that I think I can get better at before I go and just tick off a full.
And it's also still racing.
And it's still racing.
It's not like maybe like an ultra endurance event that you're holding back all the time, but still you can like push a lot of power and it's still racing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That to me is, I want to try and go as quick as I can on the bike for a short distance, and 2 hours for me is like the right distance on the bike. I think a half marathon is also a distance running that I can go and run and do fast without having to either hold back or feeling that I might get injured.
Yeah. But at this point, you've done your first 70.3. You can only take a half tattoo now, huh?
Yeah.
Not, and your calf, that
well,
half
not at all. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that one won't be happening.
All right. Again, also on this topic, we can talk for hours longer, but we already 1 hour 20 in the podcast.
Oh, I've been speaking too much.
It's flying, and we probably should do another one in the future sometime to dive deeper in different kind of topics. But I've got a couple of follower questions.
Yeah.
Before we start wrapping up the podcast, and it's like in all different kind of topics, right? It's not we have been talking about different things. First one is, how do you decide which moments are worth capturing, especially in like ultra endurance events where everything is like so exhausting and intense?
That's actually a really good question. For me, no matter what happens during an ultra, like my brain will never switch off looking for nice photos. And so it's not that I decide this is worth capturing or that's not worth capturing. If something looks nice, I'm pulling out my phone to capture it. And there were times when the last thing I wanted to do is pull out my phone, but my brain still says to me, no, like that's a scene that you're seeing that you'll never get a chance to see again. I photograph always more in the early morning and late afternoon. And so that's often, if you look on my Strava, you'll see like a lot of my rides are late in the afternoon. A lot of my activities are in the afternoon and the evening. There's a few reasons why, you know, with work and things like this, but also for me, it's just because I just like being out there in nice light. So yeah, often in the ultras, I'm shooting more in the early morning and the late afternoon. And then during the day, you know, my brain still says take a photo of that, but often the light's not quite as nice, so it doesn't look quite as nice. But yeah, I just think like for the little time it takes to grab my phone out of my cargo bib shorts pocket, open the camera and take a photo, the stuff that I look back on now, I'm so happy I've taken, you know, I think in Morocco, I must have taken, you know, 2,500 photos on my phone or something like this, plus the videos.
I think it's also rather do take something and not use it later on.
Absolutely.
Then not have been taking it, right?
Yeah. I think, like, it's nice to... Natalie always is on to me about, like, oh, live in the moment more and you don't need to capture everything, which does make sense. But equally, I think it's nice to have these moments that I can look back on. Like, Atlas Mountain Race was 3 years ago now, and I can look back on it and be like, I remember that morning because I have that photo of it. Like, if I look through my phone and I see a photo, I'm like, oh, that moment I was suffering so bad.
How often did you have to upgrade your storage on your phone?
Well, I've got a lot of hard drives of photos and things like that, and I've deleted a lot off my phone, but then I just recently got the Apple, I think it's 6 terabytes, the iCloud update.
Yeah,
so
me too.
Yeah.
Has your approach to storytelling changed since you started, especially as you've been, grown from mountain biking shoots to like ultra endurance cycling, and now you're starting out a little bit with triathlon as well? Has your storytelling been changing?
Not so much. I mean, I think I try and document things in an authentic way that, like, just reflect what I'm thinking and what I'm doing. I haven't had, like, contrary to a lot of people who have got, like, a bigger social following or a bigger YouTube account, I don't really have a strategy, strictly, mm-hmm. other than to just be as authentic as I can with what I'm doing. And so I will be putting out some triathlon content on my YouTube channel. I won't be completely transitioning to triathlon mm-hmm. on the YouTube, because
a little bit more things, right?
Yeah,
you have another whole thing to talk about, but it's still your roots is like cycling.
Yeah, and I've built an audience of cyclists. Mm-hmm. I haven't built an audience of triathletes, so I want to try and at least cater to the audience I've built. So yeah, I mean, I don't think my philosophy with storytelling's changed at all. Just be authentic and do stuff that I find interesting. And slowly, I'm also doing stuff that the audience has asked for, because I want to try and cater to the audience as well as doing what I'm doing.
Cool. As we talked about, you've tackled a lot of like seriously brutal races, like Atlas, like Piri, Badness, these kind of things. What keeps you motivated through like the toughest part of these adventures?
It really depends. I think what keeps me motivated is like doing something that I haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
It's why I loved the idea of doing triathlon. It's why I love doing the ultras, because when you haven't been to a place before, you haven't done something before, you haven't experienced before, that's like a motivation to go and do that. I also just like the idea of, like, I'm still, funnily enough, just like a lot of people, I'm still competitive. You know, I still love the idea of, like, what motivates me to get through is some kind of a result at the end, even if that result is like not something that people, like, on paper it might not look amazing. Like, when I finished 15th at Atlas Mountain Race, like, it's like it's 15th, you know, whatever, but like, to me, 15th was in a sport that I'd never done before, as in it's bike riding, but ultra racing is not really about bike riding. It's more about all the other aspects other than bike riding. So I was pretty happy with my result there, and that's what motivated me to get to the finish, was like, yep, making sure I've actually finished, I didn't pull out, getting a result that I can look on and be like, yeah, it was like a day and a bit behind the winner, which is a long period of time, but I was still, I did it in 5 days, and that to me was made me happy.
Cool. Last question is like, and this is something we probably could have been talking about earlier as well, and it can be, we can talk a long time about this, but could you explain a little bit how it works as, making a living as a photographer, videographer, or like brand ambassador, and how does this start and grow, and how your usual day or week looks like in that case?
It's always chopping and changing the way my week looks, but it's actually hard to pin it down into like a sort of a single answer, mm-hmm. comment. But with what I do, because I do a mix of creating, like, I'm a photographer, so I can create photos for other people and of other people, but I can also create photos of myself by, like, I direct shoots of myself, which sounds a bit weird, but like, I can come up with, like, I conceptualize what I want and then set up the camera and then have a camera operator who has now sort of become Natalie. But I've lent on friends before, but I've also worked with other photographers who I say, hey, this is what I'm looking to, what I'm looking to get. So yeah, I take my own skills as a photographer and apply those to photos of myself now. And that's where the brand ambassador thing has come from, where once I started writing in photos and getting more photos of myself and brands were seeing what I was doing, they were like, can we put you in our, whatever it is,
kit
or use our product. Yeah. There was a very seamless transition from like me photographing other people doing that to me being in the photos. And I bring a kind of, I now try and bring a bit of a complete package to a brand where I provide them with commercial level photos that they can use for their own marketing. And then I also allow them to leverage my audience that I've built over time by posting those photos on my own account, and because
more awareness for them. And
yeah, and it's interesting because when I was photographing cycling but not actually being in photos, I got a certain level of response from the audience. But then what was interesting was I found that people wanted to see the person behind the camera a little bit more. So like maybe every sixth post on Instagram, I would post a photo of myself and people would, you know, like the classic, it would always get more likes because I think people then see a personality that they know. And so then it was just like a matter of doing a little bit more of that and then doing a little bit more of that. And then it's a bit weird for me because I don't love the spotlight or anything. I don't love like the limelight, but I do like doing my own thing. And if people want to see that, then I'm like, cool. Okay. Let me answer that requirement or that need. And brands, I think, like that. I think in every sport, there needs to be personalities that are out there doing their own thing and creating their own thing. And, you know, I happen to have become one of those people that's doing the thing and creating the thing, not just creating the thing of other people doing the thing, if that makes sense. That's
a
roundabout way of putting it.
We have some, you just had like a couple of days with PMC, but do you have some cool stuff coming up in the next couple of months?
Yeah, for sure. I was actually meant to be doing the Trans-Pyrenees Ultra. I can't do it because of my elbow. Mm-hmm. That was meant to be at the end of this month. It's on the 29th of June. It was starting in San Sebastian, and it was 1,200 kilometers across to Jansa here on the on the coast. I can't do that.
About going there today.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Oh, nice. But yeah, I can't do that, unfortunately, because of my elbow. So that's one thing that I'll cross off. But I'm going to start looking into more triathlons that I can do once I can heal. I need to get more practice with actually racing triathlons. So this goes back to your question about what's before Worlds. I want to do one, at least one, if not two, before Worlds. Having now done one and seen the way my body responded in terms of the days after, in terms of fatigue and things like that, I think I can recover no problem. So one or two before Worlds, and then I'll do Worlds. That's a really big focus.
And for example, with like the your own social media, but also like maybe brands, these kinds of are cool projects coming up, or is it always like see what comes up?
There are a few things, but stuff that I can't mention really. Right. there'll be
people gotta follow you.
Yeah, people have to follow me. There'll be a few bike rides, there'll be a few photo shoots and a few product releases. So yeah, there's definitely stuff coming.
Cool.
But I won't give away too much yet.
All right, well, again, I think we are now at
your longest podcast 30, ever.
Well, longest podcast ever. So this is for sure a long listener people whenever they go for a ride or run.
Right? Yeah. Long car drive
back to from Switzerland to back to Jerome.
Yeah.
But it's been so nice to be chatting with you about like different kind of aspects about sports, about like photography, videography kind of things, and social media. And again, I think we should definitely do something new or whenever you are going for a full one or Ironman, whatever, another one in the future,
to go deeper into
things. But I always like to end up the podcast with the next question, and it's like, what is the one thing you would want to say to your younger self?
What I would say to my younger self is that you can do anything if you just spend some time doing it. Like, you can achieve anything if you just commit a period of time. When I was young, I really wanted to always be good at things immediately. And I'm lucky physically that my body does respond well to training. But what I've learned as I've gotten older is that there is nothing like just giving yourself a lot of time to commit to one thing and just practicing over and over and over again, and the progress will come. And I would say that to anyone. But yeah, to younger me, I'd say just calm down, understand that you need to commit years to something, and then you'll get good and it happens.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good answer.
Thanks, man.
Where's you already have a big following, but where is it that people can follow you? Instagram is Tristan Take Photo.
Yep.
YouTube is Tristan Take Video.
Tristan Take Video. Yep.
Strava.
Athletes/Tristan Kaju. Yep. And those are the three that I use. I don't use Threads, Twitter, like any of this sort of thing. Instagram and Instagram, Strava, YouTube.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool, man.
Thanks again for being on the show and talking like 1.5 hours with me about these all these cool things. And for sure, it's something looking forward to follow your journey towards the Worlds 70.3 and all the cool things you can't talk about yet that are coming up. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no worries. This was the Great Grind episode for today, and I'm looking forward to the next already. And thank you so much for listening, and get to through these 1.5 hours with us, and have a nice day. See you in the next Great Grind Girona. This podcast is brought to you by the Dutch media platform Triathlon Inside.